This exhibition of work, Craig Richards and Christine Borland, is an exhibition that was conceived of some time ago, an exhibition of discrete works by you two, but you two working very much together. Could you explain to some extent how you approached this exhibition?
Well, I suppose we were aware of what each other would be doing towards this exhibition from exhibitions we had done previous to this one, one of which was a joint exhibition 2 years ago. And we're aware of each other's work, I suppose, and we keep each other aware through either practical things or just through, I suppose, an interest in what we do.
Yeah, both of us, up until recently, lived very close to each other in Glasgow, and the exhibition that Craig was referring to, the most recent exhibition that we were in together, was called Guilt by Association in the Museum of Modern Art in Ireland. It was with three other artists, and the whole process of that exhibition was very much to do with discussing work, developing ideas, and both of us seemed to work not only necessarily for one exhibition, you know, it's an ongoing, well, my opinion is it's part of an ongoing process. So it's not always easy just to draw the line after each exhibition. The ideas keep on rolling, although, you know, they become specific depending on the location and, you know, the nature of the gallery space and the nature of the situation. So that process for Dublin, which kind of culminated in the autumn of 1992, was very much informed the way we'd be working towards the show here. Craig had made text pieces for that exhibition, and I made a small version of small objects work.
That exhibition, Guilt by Association, where Craig's work was exhibited in a separately. I mean, Craig and Christine's work both there, but in separate spaces. And in this case, the works have been very much made to be seen together. And it would be interesting for me to know why. Or at least how you see that change. I mean, the idea of looking, Craig, for example, at your work over Christine's, or Christine's, your work is, well, it's there in the reflected light of Craig's wall piece.
It's also there in the attention to detail, or the attention to vast spans of time, or something that maybe some of my work comes about through. I mean, I suppose there's a lot of joint things you could look at in the work. I mean, I feel a lot of what we do is unspoken anyway, that I'm just aware of what Christine's doing, and because she's following a certain avenue in her work, and she's suggesting to me that she's going to do this certain work, say, in Chisenhill, that encourages me to push a certain aspect of what I want to do. So you could say it's more of a process thing, and we just feel confident enough that it's going to work in the space.
One of the most obvious changes when thinking about Chisenhill from Dublin was the nature of the space, the scale, and, you know, it was from the way we work, it was obvious that we were going to take that, you know, into consideration and have it like foremost in our minds. And there was never going to be a problem with the works not working together, just because of the understanding that we have of what each other do, and the knowledge we have of how we're developing, you know, how things are going along. And as soon as I knew I was going to make the small objects piece after I'd seen it work in Dublin, my concerns for it working here were to really expand the piece, to see it on this larger scale, to see all the difference an implication that it would have in a space like this rather than in the domestic space of Dublin. So these were the sort of issues I was talking over with Craig. He would tell me about works he was planning, some of which really changed, as did my initial ideas. So we kind of changed our ideas, spoke about it, you know, just worked in tandem with each other. So it was never going to be a huge problem, because we would always be thinking of the other person, and as soon as possible would convey any changes in what we're going to do.
It's as in the case of Ireland that we initially started out with a series of works that we made each other aware of, and by the end of it, by the time of the installation, the works were completely different works. And we also did this with Jonathan. I remember telling Jonathan about a whole range of ideas, and it never came about. I mean, these were ideas that I was happy with, but it just didn't seem good for the space, which is a utopian gallery, I think. So there's so many non-specifics in the space that you can, I suppose, focus quite fiercely on the context that you supply with each other. So I think it's a good space for us.
Then again, of course, there are two other pieces as well that I haven't yet mentioned. The 9mm hole, the apples of Christine's, in the corner, six apples, each with a hole in them. And Craig's work even further, which involves a set of shelves painted blue, and on these are, not indescribable objects, but objects that refer to some sort of torture or imposed restraint, violence, and again are informed by the sorts of concerns that we see in the wall piece and small objects that save lives. I'd quite like to talk about those concerns in the exhibition overall. I mean, how you see, beyond your approach to the space and the mechanics of working together, how the eloquence of the work is changed through this collaboration.
Partly it's to do with, it can't really be disassociated from the sort of qualities of the space and the way we work. Both of us had what you might term like a major in terms of scale work that, you know, was the number one thing that we were talking about all the time. In Craig's case, it was the wall piece, and in my case, it was going to be the small objects. And then just in our sort of day-to-day working practice, you know, you're constantly developing other pieces. You know, you've got other things on the go. They might or might not become appropriate for the exhibition here in Chisenhill, but you just keep them ongoing. So I think that was certainly the case for the apples work here, that I have made it before in kind of sketch form, and there was various other pieces that it could have been. And it was determined at the time, you know, while we were actually installing the exhibition, after a number of other works were rejected, you know, they just weren't appropriate. So it was during the actual installation that the final decision to make this work was made, and that was partly in response to me feeling my way and looking at how the exhibition was developing, ideas-wise as well as formally and aesthetically, and just thinking that it would be beneficial for all of us if there was a work which contained the qualities that the apples with the 9mm holes do, something quite loose, quite apparently loose, quite flippant, something that wasn't associated with kind of cataloguing, categorising, labelling. It appeared to be quite a spontaneous gesture, so that was how I came to decide to put that work in the show.
Mm-hmm. Although unmistakably, though, within the show there's an agenda of violence, and that we, I suppose, maybe we're skirting around, and on top of that we have overlaid this idea with various categorisations and ways of presentation as a means to, I suppose, bring the viewer closer into these things rather than distancing them, which is an interesting idea as well, we could talk about later, I suppose. Within the eloquence of the work, that's an interesting idea of eloquence in terms of agenda, I suppose, combined with intention. You know, what's the intention behind us as artists, and what's our viewpoint within the work? And I think that we tried to avoid that, not for any reasons of lack of confidence in that, but more a case of it's a way of, as we're saying, bringing people closer to certain things by having a certain amount of reserve, I suppose.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, concerning the reserve that you mentioned, that in the case of Christine's work, the apples, for example, that aren't actually shot, or the small objects that save lives that aren't actually shot. The way we've talked about this a number of times, the way the work is arranged, these words, the connotations of which are awful, are so symmetrically placed on the wall, and it's actually a rather nice yellow that serves as a background for them. And that's, I think, the reserve. I mean, there is reserve in that. Mm. You know, the idea of a melodrama and a passionate gesture doesn't exist here.
Mm. It would be a hindrance to getting to understand the work. I feel it would be a way of writing off some of the aspects in the work that is somewhat difficult to talk about, because it, even in talking about it becomes melodramatic, and so you often fall into talking about the process, which is in a sense a shame, but maybe that's the fault of language. The words are so loaded that when you talk about disaster, violence and murder, barbarity, saving people's lives, a whole range of things. It becomes immersed in a whole way of thinking that I suppose that we're trying to look at, but somehow trying to have a way of studying through, maybe not deserves the right word, maybe it's a case of holding back and giving a space in between.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's not. I wouldn't call it reserve in terms of like, as you say, the words that you use, they're not at all reserved or saying small objects that save lives. Mm. It's totally emotive.
Yeah.
But you know, it's just it comes down again largely, I think, to the way we choose to present that, and the fact that we are interested in, you know, a contradictory sort of means of presentation and, you know, an idea, which, you know, the fundamentals of the idea can be quite extreme, or that, you know, one of the underlying ideas can deal with an extremeness. But to me, that wouldn't really be fully explored if that was repeated in the presentation. That would be, you know, that just wouldn't work so well for me. You know, and I feel as if that's not really... That's not part of what I'm interested in doing at all. You know, that the subject matter here in Small Objects That Save Lives, and in the other work where I've used bullets and gunfire on different types of materials, different objects, if I was to present them in a melodramatic and unreserved way, then that would just make the work become something I didn't want it to, because the actual process itself was about as kind of dramatic as you can get. So that would be far too overplayed.
And we also have the paradox as well, where people are willing to spend time and to enjoy a certain means of presentation as a means to try to understand certain agendas within the work, which is an enjoyable, you know, fun thing to do, I think.
The ambiguity there, the paradoxes, and even to an extent a sense of humour, I think, in the work that counterbalances what might be melodrama. But then but that's not to say that not anything goes in terms of interpretation of the work. If you know what I mean, that is there are particular readings that would be more appropriate for one or the other. And particularly, I would say, in looking at Craig's work on the one hand, that it's more to do with the imposition or the act of violence, whereas Christine's work tends to register some vulnerability. I mean, the apples have had this thing done to them, and the objects are there to possibly save, I mean, metaphorically speaking, or literally save someone's lives. So there seems to be this complementary relationship that exists within the works.
Yeah, I mean, that's... for myself, that's an important part of you know, my larger body of work. And in this instance, the paradox exists between the title, the loaded nature of the title, and then, you know, although there's a kind of hopefulness in making a piece like this, which is suggested by the title, when you do actually see it, and if you choose to focus in on objects individually, then it's obvious that the way that people have reacted to that title, in some ways it's a bit sad, because it's, you know, we're trying in a way to protect ourselves by caring for and loving these very precious, intimate, personal objects. But when you think of the most literal reading of the title, and you do sort of make reference to the bullet or the sort of more literal ways of ending a life, then it's obvious that these things aren't really going to protect you, so you have to look for a much more kind of metaphorical response to things. So it's kind of that sort of vulnerability and possible patheticness in the work is all part of it, as well as there's a hopefulness there that, you know, people needn't necessarily immediately be thinking of bulletproof jackets and, you know, layers of armour. You know, they can still have that ability to think of very personal things, or things which have meanings other than, you know, the literal sort of protection thing.
Well, I'm in the Institute of Contemporary Arts speaking to Eugenio Ditborn. Eugenio, could we start by discussing what you would describe as the underlying concerns of the works that you've presented here?
Well, I think that probably the first one might be what I call airmailness. I mean, all this aspect of the airmail paintings and the fact that they are folded in opposition to canvas that is completely and absolutely and definitely rigid and stretched, and this aspect in which, well, this cloth is folded and then it goes and it fits into envelopes, and the envelopes are closed, and the works travel stamped previously through the international airmail network and are exhibited at their destinations, and then stop being letters, you know, folded letters in transit, and they become suddenly unfolded paintings and are hanged on the walls and exhibited with their envelopes beside.
The other aspect is the actual imagery that the sections contain, and we're sitting in the gallery now, and without referring specifically to any of the pieces, they're normally folded sections about 8 feet by 3 feet with either photographically screened images or linear diagrams. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about your choice of imagery, because some of it is drawn from prehistory, from historical sources, violent deaths and so on.
We discuss liquid ashes. Yeah. Well, that work is from the images point of view is made of two different sets of figures or images. One set is dead persons that were preserved and found almost intact after 2,000 years. Lindoman, for instance, and 500 years of the mummy. Then, going on with the figures, there is another set of figures that are fallen figures with somebody trying to protect them. That is the image found in the television of Benedict Barrett that is in agony at the Madison Square Garden at that moment, and an image found in a magazine for children in which somebody is lying on a road, and on the other hand there is a runner lying on the runway. Well, that is a description of the human figures of that work.
One of the reasons for asking that question was the way in which in your works you've retrieved images from history and prehistory of individuals that in the main had met with violent deaths and so on. And
In here, for instance, we have a work in which we might probably start talking finally about tensions, because this is a concrete work in which an Inca boy sacrificed and preserved for 500 years get in touch with the Celtic men sacrificed as well, and on one hand, and a sort of modern version of the sacrifice might be seen there in the agony of Benedict Barrett that appeared in a television, dying. He died in television, let's say, you know. And on the other hand, this is a magazine for children that appeared in Chile about 45 years ago, and is an illustration of somebody accidented in a motorcycle. I mean, going from one place to the other and accidented.
What determines your choice of imagery?
I work in a sort of what the linguistic call the paradigm. I mean, for instance, figures dead violently, sacrificed and preserved by different means. the desert, the bog, the Andes, I mean the snow. Then we have that connection. And then there is another paradigm there of the fallen sportsmen. Fallen and abandoned, you see, because everybody there is, you know, ignoring the figure.
They're all people that are in a sense victims in society, are they not, that you've chosen? I mean, why is that?
Excluded, I would say. Excluded, marginalized, you see.
So you've, in a sense, rather like the Lindau man and the other mummified figures, you've retrieved these individuals from the anonymity of history.
Yes, probably by connecting them. Because when you say that, I say yes, but that's not all. It's not that they are there, they are together. I mean, you see, you have this abyss, is what's in between, you see? That is the treasure. What is in between these faces, these abysses? I mean, you see? This, what, at the beginning you were talking about these different times, and the different layers and the different histories, you see? The work should have to repeat a sort of pre-established connection. I mean, there's nothing. I mean, there's a sort of darkness there. The work produces the connections and produces a meaning, because it connects the unconnected.
The works are often a collage of imagery derived from differing periods, and you use the term hybridization in my work is of a temporal kind. I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, what I try to build, to construct, is a sort of pluridimensional time in which I create intersections and connections of figures that were alive in a certain period of history, and then that are found afterwards. So in a way, it's a sort of collection of remains that each of them contain a different time. So the intersection then is a sort of plural intersections of different times. I think it's a very Latin American, is a very important aspect of Latin American culture, the sort of pre-modern, modern and post-modern layers that you can find, you know, walking in the street. In 10 minutes you can get in touch with absolutely different histories and times. And all of them are still sort of alive. Well, what I do is to like, you can put a sort of a piece of dry meat into the water to make it softer, and then to be able to expand it, and then to look at it. That's in a way what I do, you see, to work with several pieces of different dry meats.
It seems that both in terms of the themes of your work, and as you described it, the airmailness of the works, there is a very specific sense of the works being produced in Chile, a location away from the so-called centre. And in the catalogue, there is this notion of works coming through the mail by virtue of the mail service from the so-called periphery to the centre.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like sort of bridges that this airmailness opens. You know, I mean, to finish or to make the critic of the exiled against the one that never went out or never went away. So they are exiled for a while, and they belong to Chile for another while, you see, but they don't stay or they don't remain in any place for more than let's say 3 months, 4 months. So what they finally might be called, the airmail paintings, is homeless. I mean, they are really homeless.
So there's a real sense of the transitional, of the temporary, of the fragile,
yes,
that seems to be a resonance attached to this work.
Yeah, yes.
You come from Chile, and you've made your work there. I wondered if you could talk about the relationships between your work and your country, your cultural context. I mean, how would you be specific about the links and the relationships?
You see, my country is, as most of the Latin American countries, have the capacity to forget everything. You see? Then things become buried, and are buried very, very soon, you see, and pass very, very soon. And other things remain there, you don't know how. Then my specific work is to unbury, to classify all these remains and to order them, to make them legible and to connect them, to create meaning. It's a sort of didactic work I do. It's sort of strange didactic thing, you see?
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
I do. I used the term earlier, a form of iconographic archaeology or cultural archaeology. Archaeology to do with ideas and histories.
Yes, 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 very much.
Can we talk about the material you use? Because it's a non-woven material that actually is used in the linings of cheap clothes, isn't it? Why do you use this material?
Well, I have used this material because when you touch it, you have this sort of mixture of a thick paper and a thin cloth. And if you think a little bit, you will see that, well, most of the graphic tradition was made on paper, and all the painting tradition was made on canvas. So this is already it escapes, you see, from the graphic tradition and the painting tradition, and uses both at the same time in several senses, you see. And well, it's very light. You can fold it by, you iron it, you know, in a dry cleaning. You can put that eyelets on it. It's very easy to hang, and probably for this group of works, what is the most important thing is that that cloth or this non-woven fabric receives this liquid and is impregnated by the liquid. So there's now a covering painting, as all painting, because painting covers, and this goes into the support. You see, it's like, then it is a lot to do with the secretions. You say secretion in English? All the secretions from the human body, you see, and all these secretions, as you know, are all of them related to passion, you see? Ejaculating, you know, crying, saliva, you know. And they are crossed by this liquid that looks non-dry. If you look at it, it's sort of thing that is not dry, still dry.
It gives a feeling of being an absorbent material, rather like cotton wool or blotting paper that takes up a trace of what it's touched.
Exactly. Then this might be one of another critic of easel painting. The fact that it's painted, the material, the inscription is not on, but into.
Andrew Sabin, we're about to enter your work, which is called The Sea of Sun, here at BAC, formerly Battersea Art Centre in South London. And when I say enter, in fact, we're about to walk through what is an anodized aluminium chain curtain. And perhaps whilst we do this and walk into the gallery, you could describe the sort of physical structure of the work.
The gallery at BAC has is two rooms. There's an entry, small entry into the first room, which is the smaller of the two, which we're going into now. And as soon as we're through the first curtain that goes across the door, we find ourselves in a small enclosure about 6 feet by five, with a aluminium, perforated aluminium ceiling. And we're surrounded by a perspective pattern, perspectival pattern, based on an iris and a pupil. And as we walk on through it, immediately you draw back the curtain, there's an instant transition into a totally different kind of pattern, of bright colours on a flower kind of theme. And then onwards, another instant raising of temperature into red and purple with a kind of sunburst pattern. And then on again into a different lower temperature sort of seeding cell-like enclosure. And as we move the curtains closed behind us, if you turn around, you can see a kind of vista of accumulation of the enclosures, because the curtains are visually permeable, so that one isn't simply presented by the pattern of the nearest curtain, but there's layer after layer, which makes an ever-increasing complexity of visual effect.
As we walk through this next curtain into a space that is quite cool in a way, I mean, I think one should say that the aluminium chain curtains do have colours imposed upon them, and there are in fact 26 of these compartments, and the overwhelming sense I get, I've seen it a few times now, is that of quite staggering sort of ambition in terms of the technical nature of this installation. There's something like, I believe, 28,000 metres of anodized aluminium chain curtains. But did you make the piece, conceive the piece, for this particular space at Battersea?
Yes, I did. It's modular in structure, and it can be rejigged to fit other spaces. I'm also interested to see it as an object. At the moment, you never are in a situation where you can see the totality of the work. As soon as you enter the gallery, you're inside the work, and that's the only experience that's available to you.
Shall we move through the space now to the next gallery? And we, as we do it, we pull the curtains back. Actually, if we stop here, Andrew, the word green appears on a green curtain, behind which there's a sort of almost a negative or a residue of the staircase outside in black and white.
Yeah. Well, to get into the gallery, you'd have had to have come up the staircase. So, in a sense, in terms of one's movement, that's the most recent memory of your environment. So, it's the only image in this particular room. We're still in the first room, and in a way I wanted these a sense that somehow the machinations of all these patterns overlaid and transformed at a particular point in the room coalesce into a kind of record of where you've been.
I mean, before we leave this room, I'm just thinking back to what you're saying perhaps about another level of representation of reality of experience. And I just wondered the extent to which scientific levels of experience and of reality, that is of the microbe, the atom, and so on, interest you and perhaps inform some of the imagery and structures that you actually deal with in your work.
Very much so. I have no great skills with science language, but in the last 10 or 12 years, there's been an explosion of popularizations. Biologists Richard Dawkins, Douglas Hofstadter, with the Bach-Escher-Gödel book, endless sort of tower of physics kinds of things. And the imagery that they make available is very much compatible with the kinds of things that artists have been dealing with for quite a while. And I found a fantastic source, really.
The other reference that immediately comes to mind in terms of the structure of the curtains and the way that one can move through a series of modular spaces is that of the maze. I wondered whether the idea of a maze, either actual or metaphorical, was part of your thinking in making this work.
Yeah. Well, it isn't. It's a paradoxical maze because you can go anywhere, and although it makes you feel like there is a route, there is no route. There's an infinite potential for routes in this space. And each route gives a different ordering of experience.
So part of engagement with the work is actually defining one's movement through it.
In a sense, yes. Mm. I mean, whenever you stop, you're exactly where you are, and where you have been is no longer visually accessible with the same clarity as it did have when you were there, because you're having to see through new layers of information.
Just before we move in, there is a strange paradox with the chain curtains, one of which is that of quite extraordinary solidity and surface, but at the same time they are translucent, or rather transparent. You can see through them.
Mm. I'd been looking for years for something that would enable an audience to enter a sculpture rather than simply consider surfaces. And I experiment with all kinds of plastic strips and God knows what. And I stumbled across this stuff in the doorway of a bookmaker's shop and discovered that it had a fantastic potential. If you're perpendicular to a screen, it is very permeable. As soon as you move around and look obliquely, the nature of the chain blocks off the visual permeability, so it becomes a solid.
Well, shall we move through? I mean, the gallery here, I should say, is rather like an H shape, but now we're going through the passage that connects us to the next gallery.
The grid form that I've employed throughout the gallery, it does give a fantastic opportunity to make kind of wild organic events without them kind of escaping into something rather gratuitous. That I think there's quite a good balance here. Perhaps that there's been an attempt or desire to create an environment where a certain event takes place, and the environment might be constructed by a certain set of forces or certain types of boundaries, and within it the event might be completely other than the nature or seeming nature of the environment that it takes place within.
And the other issue that I think one should really discuss here is the way in which you've used a computer to generate all of this imagery, or just some of it.
All the imagery apart from the monochrome images. I should say that the staircase that we talked about earlier and all the faces are monochrome. All the patterns are in pretty bright colours. So in effect, each link is a kind of pixel. But unlike pixels on a computer screen, which are, you know, they're either pink or blue or black or white, these are at one time let's say, green, but they are visually permeable, so that behind them might be some red, and behind that one is also visually permeable. So it's there's a kind of layering of pixelated information.
There's one other thing. As we walk through the space out of the green enclosure now into one that's richer in terms of, or more sumptuous perhaps in terms of reds and purples, I'd like to return to something you've written, and you talk about one of the objectives, and I quote, one of the objectives of the work is to draw a relationship between thought and the virtual reality of computer-generated space. And I wondered, as we're nearing the end of walking around the installation, you could elaborate a bit on that statement.
In a sense, the world as we perceive it is a kind of partial computer-generated environment. We're handling pieces of information in the form of light. We're putting it through a certain kind of biological hardware. We're storing it. We're comparing it. When it enters the hardware, it's translated from light into a chemical language. Perhaps a rhythmic language. We don't really know how those levels of translations work in the brain, but one could quite easily predict that if we had a different kind of hardware structure, like a bat or a dolphin that does echolocation, for example, they know the world, they get around fantastically, they survive, they have complex social groupings, and their construction of the world is based purely on sound bounced off whatever is out there. It must seem to them a totally different place. The structure in here is purposefully resonant of pixelated computer images. At the same time, the mood, I hope, I'm fairly confident that I've achieved it, is one that is quite akin to any individual's experience. People, when they come in here, feel comfortable. Which is curious. It's we're in a little box at the moment, 4 foot by 6 foot, with a bright light coming through the ceiling, and yet one can spend a very long time in here and not feel in any way oppressed.